Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share their failure stories, but also lessons they learned and how they responded to failure. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. I'm looking forward to sharing these conversations with you. As you might guess, because of my profession, I'll be talking to folks who have religious backgrounds, but I won't be exclusively talking to people in those worlds. My guest in this podcast, however, is one of the most notable leaders in the United Methodist Church. Adam Hamilton is the founder and senior pastor of the Church of the Resurrection, located in the Kansas City area. CORE is the largest United Methodist Church in the United States, and Adam's many books and his own leadership have had a profound impact on our denomination. In this podcast, Adam shares from his own successes and failures in ministry, and he also reflects on the future of our denomination. I hope you enjoy it. Well, welcome to the Failing Boldly podcast, Adam Hamilton. It was so great that you would take the time to spend with us today.
Christian, I'm really excited to be with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think many of our listeners are United Methodist and know of you and your church. We also will have quite a few folks who either may not be familiar with Church of the Resurrection or the United Methodist Church. So I was wondering if you could start by talking about the beginnings of Church of the Resurrection, how you not just went into the ministry, but how you became to be a church planter, and some of those early days of both the successes and the things that didn't quite go so well.
Sure. Well, I was 25 years old when I was sent to start Church of the Resurrection, and it was a dream that I had had. I had told our bishop, well, my superintendent, who told the bishop, I hope, that I had either wanted to take a dying, you know, urban church. I said, give me the hardest church, the one that's failing. Give me a chance. Just give me, put me in, coach. Give me a chance to see if I could turn it around, in particular in an area where there were people living, young people moving into. You know, there's an area in Kansas City that's kind of the hip, you know, lots of bars and all that. And I said, I'd love to go there, or let me start a new church to try to reach thinking people who are non-religious and nominally religious. And so eventually, after 2 years of, you know, pleading with them and finally narrowing the focus to starting a new church, they allowed me to come and do this. We were severely underfunded, and I actually think that was not a bad thing. They provided my associate pastor's salary of $25,000 the first year, and they gave me, I think they paid my insurance and pension, and they gave us, I believe it was $10,000. That was the startup, deal. And then they told me they were going to give me a 20% pay cut every year after that. So I better, I better find people or I was going to starve. So that was a good incentive, but it really, that wasn't the incentive. I just had this passion for wanting to reach people who didn't know Christ or weren't involved in a church and to try to speak their language. And the community was one where I had grown up in. I had come to faith in Christ in this community. I had graduated from high school, met my wife here. And so I knew the area. I knew how people thought, I felt. And so that's, we began that way. We started in a little funeral home chapel, and we had 90 people on our first, we averaged 90 people the first month we were going. Mm-hmm. And, those folks were mostly non-church people, and I think did a pretty good job of trying to follow up with them, casting a vision of how this little church meeting in a mortuary could actually change the world. And I think we spoke their language, and they kept coming, and they brought their friends, and their friends brought their friends. And so, today we're a church of, during the school year, at least on a given weekend, we'll have close to 10,000 people in physical, physically present at one of our four campuses here in Kansas City. And we'll have another probably 3,000 people who join us online. Mm. And it's been an exhilarating adventure. Not always up. There have been shares of, peaks and valleys. And I like your podcast title, Failing Boldly, which I think is from your book. And that's a part of it too. Yeah, you're going to have really amazing adventures, and you're going to have some times where you feel like quitting and throwing in the towel. And that's true in every area of leadership. We're all, if you're going to make a difference, you're also going to take risks. You're going to do things that are, hopefully you have more successes than failures, but we're all going to miss it sometimes.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the valleys. You talked about the peaks and valleys, and I think most folks who know about you and your church, know about your many books and your leadership and the impact you're having on Kansas City and beyond. But I think folks would also love to hear at least a story or two of when is a time that you tried something and it just didn't go as like you thought it would.
Yeah. Well, we've tried a lot of things that probably didn't go as well as we hoped they would go. We're constantly adapting and changing. So I'll mention two things. First of all, I'll mention not necessarily something we tried and failed at, but just the fact that if you are leading a congregation, you are going to have people who at times, if you're in leadership, can have people who are at times not happy with the leadership that you're giving. They're not going to like the things you've said or taught or where you're going. And, you know, and over the years, I've had sermons or I've had seasons where we had more people leaving the church than join the church. And those are painful. And you know, even to this day, yesterday I got into the office after being gone for 3 weeks and I had 12 emails that were, that needed to be responded to that were, I don't like this thing you did, or I'm so disappointed you did that, or how come you're not around more, or, you know, and you get these things and every time you get one, it feels like somebody's just punched you in the gut, you know, and it's easier at 52 to deal with them than it was at 35. At 35, I felt like I had to give a detailed, a defense of, my position or what I was doing. And today I find it much easier to say, gosh, I'm sorry that hit you that way. And I can understand why that would have been painful for you, and know that that wasn't my intention and I love you. And, we may not agree on this, but I still love you. That's easier to say today. Probably at 35, I felt like I had to write a 5-page email responding to everyone. And that takes you, 3 hours of time. And it probably didn't convince many people. Usually those are more therapeutic than they are actually helping people. So I'll give you an example, and then we'll come back to your, the things we failed at. But there's a guy who I won't go into the details because it would be releasing confidentiality, but it was a situation where he had a pastoral need and I didn't respond in the way that he hoped I would. And then I was gone for the last few weeks speaking at annual conferences and taking vacation. So when I came back, he'd been stewing on it for 4 weeks. And he sent me a 2-page letter or maybe 3 pages, talking about, well, if I had money, you would have treated me differently. And this kind of stuff that's just, that's just not true. Or you didn't care. You cared more about, whatever you were doing than you cared about me in the moment and all these kind of things. And so at first I felt, defensive, like, what do you, do you really think I go around deciding who I'm going to care for based upon whether they, how much money they gave? I mean, I don't even know how much money people give. I have access to that information. I don't even look at it. So, not that during capital campaigns, you have to look at it, but I started getting defensive, and then I thought, no, this guy's just hurting. He's just hurting. Mm-hmm. And so I got rid of the email I was thinking about sending, which was kind of helpful to write out. And I said, gosh, I'm so sorry. I can see how you would feel that way. And that would never have been my intention. And I need you to know, I don't even look at what people give for the very reason that I want to be tempted to give special attention to certain people rather than others. And I hope you'll forgive me. And I just want you to know, I love you. I know you were hurting and that was never my intention. And, it was amazing. I got up this morning and here's this email, they sent back just very conciliatory and thank you so much. And I just so struggled with this. And it was like, had I sent the first email, I would have, I just would have hurt him more.
Yeah.
As opposed to actually, being reconciled. Now I can't always send those kind of emails and sometimes I blow it and I've had that happen when it comes to talking about issues. So again, this is not the failure thing so much, but there are times where I have preached on issues and with the Trump election, there's been several sermons in there. And over the last year I've had, I usually have one series a year that's dealing with, ethical issues that are, high profile at the time. So last year we did a series called The Issues That Divide and we took a look at healthcare, immigration, Islamic extremism, guns. I can't remember what the other one was. And I try in those sermons to represent both sides fairly and then come out and say, but here's how I see it. It's okay if you disagree with me, but here's how I see it. But no matter what, you're going to have times where you're going to say things that alienate people. And there have been times where I've looked back at sermons and I've thought, I could see how that may be, it's how I felt in the moment. And I thought I was being faithful, but that might not have needed to be quite so bombastic, or it wasn't bombastic, but quite so one-sided. Mm-hmm. And I pride myself on not doing that, but there are times I have. And so in those situations, again, inevitably there'll be people who are thoughtful people and they're sitting in the congregation. They're like, that bozo has no idea what he's talking about. And some of them will let me know that. And if I have a chance to respond, like I was preaching on Syrian refugees. last fall. And I went and interviewed a refugee family here in Kansas City on video, and I prepared this message. And, you know, one of the guys who'd been around the church for a long time, a you know, really great guy, was so upset by it, he just stopped coming to the church. Mm. And I didn't find out except that we call people after they miss 3 weeks in a row. And so we found out that way. And, you know, he said, well, I just have struggled since Pastor Adam's sermon on Syrian refugees. And so, you know, I was able to call him up and say, hey, let's get together and talk. And we sat down and talked, and what I found is that he heard one thing that wasn't exactly what I intended or said. And at the same time, as we talked, you know, I said, I think you and I are not that far apart. We agree on X, Y, and Z, you know, but we might see this differently. By the time we were finished, you know, we were reconciled, and he was like, hey, I so appreciate the fact that you invited me to come in and talk. The challenge for me is there for everyone that I know about and have time to visit with, there's probably 20 I don't. And so, you know, that's a bit of a challenge too. I could spend all my time either trying to water down sermons so I don't say anything or just trying to, you know, to have those kind of meetings. But anyway, I would just say all of those leave you when you get those emails, and I'm guessing, Christian, you have got to get those from time to time too.
At least a couple, yes.
Yeah. Human sexuality is one of the big ones.
Sure.
And so, you know, you can find yourself deflated. You can feel like, why am I doing this? You know, and you feel like you want to give up. And I just remind people, you know, when you've either failed or you didn't fail, you did the right thing, but people misunderstood or they're just mad. You know, I think back of all the people in the Bible who had those experiences. You know, Moses who went out and in essence prayed, God, kill me now. I'm sick of these people. You know, and they wanted to vote him off the island and back to Egypt. Every other leader, you know, you think about Elijah and you know, Queen Jezebel and King Ahab's, you know, intention to kill him. You think about Paul and how many times he was beaten and of course, you know, Christ who was crucified and John Wesley and anybody else who's ever tried to lead, you know, people where they don't, you know, where they don't necessarily think they want to go or stands up for something that people aren't really certain about, they're going to be, you know, they're going to have people upset with them sometimes. And sometimes those people who are upset with you are right. Mm. And, you know, I found that too, that sometimes I could have said something differently or better or more, you know, more graciously and or sometimes I could have done things better than I did. And so, you know, there's always that challenge.
Yeah, it sounds like in listening to you that you have, I would imagine it's somewhat intentional, a practice of pausing and doing some real reflecting on whether it is somebody perceived that you failed in some way through a sermon or some other way, or if you tried some ministry and didn't work out so well. I think the temptation is always, because we're human, to take it to heart, like, oh, why did I say that? Or why did I do that? Or why did I move forward with that? And then to really beat yourself up over it. And it sounds like there's that initial sting for you, as it is with all of us, but then also taking a little bit more time and to be reflective on, all right, what's really happening here? And how can I respond in a way that's a little more patient, a little more humble, a little more loving?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And there are a few times where you know, you can even try to do that. And at the end, the reality is this person's, they're going to leave, you know, they're not going to stay. But I do think that pause for a little bit and then to be able to, I think for us as pastors, and this is probably true for a lot of leaders, our identity is so caught up in what we do. Mm-hmm. And our perspective is so in the now, in the moment. And, you know, you got to look over a lifetime of ministry, you know, when you get to the end. And I think it was St. Augustine who, by the time he got to the end of his life, and he wasn't the only one, others did the same thing. Their last book was something like, what did they call it? It was, in essence, you know, here are all the mistakes I made across the course of life. And they looked back over their writings and said, you know, that was just stupid. I said that, or I wished I hadn't said that. And so I think, you know, I think you look over the course of your life and whatever the thing is right now in the moment, probably over the next 10 or 20 years will not be the thing. Mm-hmm. And if you can have a little perspective and, you know, having been here at Resurrection 27 years, you know, I've figured out a few things. One is out of every conflict or every, you know, every challenge, every difficult period, if we continue to open ourselves to God's work and the Spirit and we keep trying to do the right thing, God inevitably somehow brings something good from it. Mm. When there are problems, there are always solutions. I don't know what they are yet, but there are solutions to those problems. And so instead of feeling like, oh my gosh, the sky's falling, I'm like, okay, well, it'll be interesting to see what God does with this, you know, or how we're going to work ourselves out of this, you know, this mess. But inevitably, it always works out that way. And so, you know, as long as we're faithful, I think, and trying to listen and do the right thing. And the other thing I've learned is, you know, that you, to the degree possible, you always want to be as transparent as possible. Mm-hmm. And that, and you want to, you know, you don't want to hide your head in the sand. So I have a friend who tells me facts are our friends, and you want to know. I mean, we want to survey our congregation to find out, what are they thinking? What are they feeling? Where are we not getting it right? And how can we do it better? Mm-hmm. So, but one of the things I was thinking about when it comes to failure, so this is an example that a lot of churches will wrestle with. We had several years ago, we recognized our two primary morning worship services in the sanctuary were traditional, choir and orchestra. And then actually all three of our morning services were traditional, and then our evening services were contemporary. And, you know, we began to notice the community's aging, not just the church, but the area around us. We were reaching young people in Sunday mornings, and some of them who preferred traditional worship, but we also were finding that there were, you know, that we were missing a whole bunch of people who would have come on Sunday morning if we had a contemporary option. And we started one in our student center, and that went pretty well. It actually, you know, went gangbusters and grew to, you know, probably 600-700 people. But in the sanctuary, we were not offering that. And so, you know, I felt like we've got to make a change. We've got to offer a contemporary option at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. Well, you know, you go to change the 9 o'clock service, and everybody who's in there is pretty used to what they get, you know, and we're all creatures of habit, and we resist change. We don't like things to be different. We went to make a change, and I thought, and this was hard enough because I knew, man, I'm going to get hell for this in doing it. But I had conviction that if we wanted to be a church that was going to continue to reach future generations, we had to make a change on Sunday morning in at least one of our services. So we got ready to do that, and then I began thinking, okay, how can I do this in a way that's the least disruptive as possible? And so what we did is we brought our evening contemporary guy into Sunday morning at 9, and we kept our Sunday morning traditional guy, and we had them try to work together on something. And they're both very gifted musicians. But what it felt like to the 9 o'clock service is we had just they intentionally decided to come at 9 o'clock, both for the traditional, but also because they didn't want to be a part of that evening thing, you know. And so we brought the evening guy in the morning, and no matter how good he did or what a great job he did, they felt there was a resistance to him. And by keeping the traditional guy involved, we were really kind of halfway putting our feet into doing something different. And so the folks who really wanted contemporary weren't happy, and the folks who really wanted the traditional weren't happy. And we watched attendance drop by like 40% over the next year in that service. And, you know, I kept, here's why we're doing it. Here's why we're doing it. But, and finally we had to say, okay, this is bleeding too much, and it's not, and we're not seeing the new people coming in. And so we, you know, we recognized that, I had made a bad call. It was, and you know, we as a team, but primarily me, and we needed to do something different. And so we brought in somebody who could kind of stabilize it, and they stabilized it for the next few years, and the attendance came back up some. And basically it was like 5 steps forward, 3 steps back. Mm-hmm. So still moved 2 steps forward, but we had, you know, just the strategy that we took was not the right strategy.
Yeah.
So, you know, more recently we said, okay, so we stabilized it, but we still haven't addressed the problem. We really need what around here we're calling modern worship, but we really need, I don't know that that's our term we came up with. A lot of people probably use it, but, we need a service that's more like that, you know, a service that will be more appealing to the 20 and 30 year olds. So, you know, we went through a little different process where, you know, we finally made the change. It was painful. We lost some people. But I think we're on the right track now. And I won't really know for another year or two if that's the case. But at this point, it looks like we've, you know, we're probably on the right track.
Yeah.
And so here's the point I would make. When it comes to failing, you know, the aim is to learn from your mistakes. It's to learn from the places where things didn't work out the way you wanted them to. It's to give them enough time to, you know, because you're going to have a period in which things are going to drop, right? You're going to lose some vitality because people are mad and they leave or whatever. And a lot of people give up right then. You know, I think we did right by saying we're going to wait for a year and see, you know, and look to see what we can do to improve this. But then there comes a point where you go, okay, I got to admit this didn't go the way I was expecting.
Yeah.
A loss of 40% and not seeing anybody new, or very few people new joining, that's not a success. And so then regrouping and saying, okay, we're going to make another change. And that change, you know, I think was the right change for the moment. And then finally coming back over the last year, and we had lots of late night conversations, and I'm like, do I want to go through this again? And I know these, you know, some of these people are going to hate us for this. But I think we've got to do this. We've got to figure this out. And if the first solution wasn't the right solution, we've got to find the right solution. And, you know, and that leads to, hopefully leads to success.
Yeah. Do you find over the years the more, I guess, quote unquote, successful Church of the Resurrection has become, has it made it more challenging to take risks, or do you still feel like you're able to do that compared to when you were drawing 90 at the funeral home?
Right. Well, it's much easier when you're smaller to take risks and to turn on a dime. Mm-hmm. The reason why it's easier to take risks when you're smaller is you have a personal relationship with everybody who's there. And so they all know you. You know, when you find out somebody's not happy, you sit and talk to them over a cup of coffee right after worship. In some senses, it's more challenging, because if you lose 20% of your people, that's a huge amount in a church of 90 people. But I found in some ways it was easier when we were smaller to take those risks and to change quickly. You know, we could announce something and we could change it in 2 weeks. Well, today we have so many moving parts. It's like a giant ship. You know, you don't turn a giant ship around in the same way you turn a canoe around. Mm-hmm. You know, those two things take a different amount of time to turn things. And our, there are so many moving parts that when, you know, it used to be, I'd come back from my summer, you know, time away of reading and reflection and prayer, and I'd say, oh, you know, here's where we're going to go. You know, it's sort of Moses coming down from the mountain with the vision. And at some point we moved to being a size where when I did that, it was crushing to people, because they already had things they'd been working on for 2 years and strategic plans and all these kind of things. Now all of a sudden Adam went up on the mountain and he came down with some harebrained idea, and I got to stop what I've been working on for 2 years in order to pursue this. And that's just demoralizing to everybody. So I've learned that the visions need to percolate up more from the people. So I'm going to have visions from time to time, but I'm going to remind them of why we're here and what we're about, and invite the Holy Spirit to work through our ministry leaders and directors. And then together we're going to dream and vision. We're going to look to see what problems need to be solved in Kansas City, what areas, you know, people are not being reached in, and how we can reach them. And we're going to take it a little bit slower. Mm. And so I have found that's the case.
Has been a challenge for you? Because I think for leaders, regardless of what field they're in, especially if it's a smaller institution or if you're an entrepreneur starting something, there's that initial, like, I helped create this thing. And so the temptation is to say, and therefore I know the way to go. And so there's that kind of casting the vision. And then as you do both get bigger and or get older, it's more challenging to be able to do that. But I think there's wisdom and also beginning to listen to the folks around you, and so that they also have that share in the vision. And so has that been easy for you to make that transition, or is that still a challenge for you?
Both, actually. I think it became easier when I understood just the damage you could do when you're just coming in and telling everybody, this is the direction we got to go now, and let's do it with some new vision that you're pursuing. Now, again, there has to be a place for that, for the senior pastor to be able to have that kind of vision. But you know, I think it's valuable when you're inviting a whole lot of people to dream together, to go through the kind of strategic planning process, the dreaming process. But it's frustrating sometimes too. There'll be times where it's like, okay, I really want to do this, and we can make it happen. But then I find out, you know, people are grumbling on the sides. Well, you know, how, here we are again. Adam's trying to tell us how we got to do everything. And so I think it's part of the leadership challenge, the whole journey. You know, you find yourself at times, the church isn't moving fast enough, and I can't figure out, why can't we get this done? This shouldn't be that hard, you know?
Yeah.
And there are times where you have to be the driver who's actually saying that.
Yeah.
You know, you can relinquish all leadership, and that's not good either. There's a balance between being the leader who's, you know, pushing, and being the person who's also carefully listening and not killing your people, mm-hmm. or demoralizing them.
Yeah.
I was thinking something about failure as we were talking about that. I'm a big Apple geek, and I've got I'm sitting at my desk in my office, and across from my desk is my little collection of Apple stuff. So one of my favorite illustrations that I use is, I've got the original Apple Newton. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember this or not, but it was a handheld, it was a PDA, and a personal digital assistant. You had a pen and you could write on it, and it had a screen, and it had like four apps, I think. And if you spent the money, you could actually get a modem and connect to the internet. And the thing was, it was too big to fit in a pocket. It didn't recognize handwriting very well. And it was, it ended up, they made like five versions of it. Apple did, over like a 5 or 6 year period of time. and they lost a boatload of money on it. It was a disaster financially. And what's interesting is the processor, which is inside the RISC processor, inside years later became the same architecture for the iPhone.
Oh, interesting.
And then the iPad. And so I love to hold that up just to say, here was a glorious failure. Mm-hmm. They learned from that failure. They had the right idea. They just had the wrong timing and implementation. And when they came back, they revolutionized. Actually, they revolutionized. It was the second wave of the digital revolution, I think, or the third when you talk about the iPhone and the phone that basically becomes a computer in your hand that does everything that computers used to do. But that wouldn't have happened were it not for the failure. And I've got an Apple camera up here, which was a disaster, and it utterly failed. But that became, you know, that became integrated into the iPhone, and suddenly it changed how we take pictures today.
Yeah.
So, you know, you think of these things that were failures, but then turned into successes. And I was at an event in Aspen, Colorado recently, and one of the speakers was Astro Teller from Google X. It's just now called X, but it's sort of the R&D division of Google.
Okay.
And they were talking about how they celebrate failure. And how, you know, when a team fails and they did something, they came up with a, they look for what are problems, big problems that need big solutions. And then they brainstorm solutions and they spend some money and time trying to figure out what they could do to fix, you know, to address that. And then there comes a point where they say, okay, this just won't work. It's just not financially viable, or we can't make it work. And they have this big, you know, celebration for these guys. Like, you tried something, you tried something, even if it didn't work, you moved the ball forward. Now we know that doesn't work. And so we're not going to make you feel bad because you failed. We're going to say you tried something. Way to go. That was awesome. Now let's figure out what the next thing is we're going to try.
Yeah.
And I think that's something you don't see a lot in the church world.
No, in fact, that's a good transition into my next question I talk about this a little bit in the book as far as talking about the state of the mainline and the state of the United Methodist Church. And I think because there have been so many articles written and people have seen the statistics about the decline of the mainline, the decline of the United Methodist Church, and I think what sometimes happens is people see that, and so they just grasp on to the success stories so tightly and said, well, here, we need to just do more of this. And I think we sometimes miss out on, but also here are some ministries, some churches that are trying something. It didn't quite work out, but let's also hold that up as a way to move forward. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your sense of, because you're such a leader in our denomination, what is your sense of how the denomination may see itself as failing, and what might be able, what we might be able to do to kind of come out of that decline?
Well, we've got several issues, and of course, right now the big issue is that we're making human sexuality the central focus of our conversations. When in fact, we got gaping holes in the ship, and those need to be repaired. Mm. And human sexuality is really important, and it's something we have to talk about. But I don't think we're not going to get to agreement on human sexuality by having 800 people get together once every 4 years from around the world to vote. This is not how this issue will be resolved. It's resolved in large part, it's resolved in asking questions about the nature of Scripture. It's resolved around getting to know people. It's resolved in the local church setting. Our Sunday school classes have figured out how to live with each other, even though they have differing views and opinions. Those views change over time because we get to know people, and getting to know people leads us to ask questions. And but to think we're going to come up with something in the Book of Discipline that's going to change that is, to me, is just not a realistic expectation. And so, you know, my hope would be that we could say, let's figure out, you're not asking me about this, but I'm going to say it anyway, that we could figure out a way to say, let's let local churches and pastors resolve this question, and not make this the central focus of our denomination. Let's agree that we're going to respect people and love people and welcome people, but let's let local churches figure this out, and let local church pastors determine who they're going to marry, and let annual conferences determine how they practice ordination. And I think that 10 years from now resolves the issue. Not everybody will be along for that same journey, and there's going to be 10% or 15%, or I pray not 20%, but or 30%, but there's going to be X number of churches that if we don't do this well in the conversations are going to opt to leave. Mm-hmm. And that could lead to some, you know, serious rethinking of how we do things as a church, and that could be a good thing. So I trust that no matter what happens, it's all going to work out okay. But I think the denomination, you know, in my mind, the innovations And creating vital congregations does not happen from the top down. It happens in raising up outstanding leaders and giving them an education that they need and inspiring and encouraging them and setting them free to be innovators and entrepreneurs, or, you know, renovators or, you know, revivalists or whatever. And so, you know, you have this vision, you and Trey have this vision in Urban Village. I don't know what role the denomination played in giving you that, but I'm pretty sure the General Conference did nothing to make that happen. It was a dream that you guys had and a vision you had, and there were other people who fanned the flame and encouraged you. And I think that's how innovation happens. We've got a good theology as United Methodist. The mainline churches have, if they hold on to it, you know, both the evangelical side of the gospel and the social side of the gospel, if we bring together the head and the heart and then send people out to do work with, you know, with their hands and serving Christ, we have a thoughtful gospel that people need, and one that answers questions that non-religious people are struggling with when it comes to faith. So I think we have the right answers. I think sometimes we've forgotten those answers. Sometimes our own personal spirituality, I mean, in order to do what you're doing, in order to do what anybody's doing, where they're committing a great deal of their time and energy, requires a set of convictions, personal convictions about this matters. I'm willing to give my life for this. I believe the gospel is, you know, however you describe it, this is what it does. And so I think we need to be, we clearly can lift up examples of excellence, and we need that, because sometimes people need their creativity. You know, they need to just go, oh my gosh, look what could happen there. Look what they did there. And they can't all be, you know, resurrection models. I mean, I think we have a lot to teach people, and we try to figure out, okay, how does what we do relate to a church of 50? I mean, when I'm speaking at annual conferences, I try to take every idea I share and tone it down to be, here's what you could do in a church of 50 people or 30. But we also need pictures that are not, you know, and we've got four campuses. We've got a downtown campus with a large number of former prostitutes. And I mean, every one of our campuses are different, but we need urban villages to succeed. We need, you know, we need lots and lots of congregations who can both talk about how they failed. But if you talk about how you failed, but I don't see any way that you also succeeded, then I think, well, I feel better now because I know you failed too, but I need to know, okay, but it can work too. And here's what it looked like. And that success isn't 20,000 people or 10,000 people. It's, you know, but it is a self-sustaining congregation of people who are changing the world.
Yeah.
And I think our denomination, I am not looking to General Conference, the Book of Discipline, our general boards and agencies to save the church. I'm looking for them to sometimes get out of the way, to sometimes empower, and to encourage and foster an environment where people can kind of like moonshot it at Google X, you know, a place where innovators can be set free to innovate as opposed to being squelched, which is what often happens in our denomination today, I think, is we tend to squelch the innovators or the, you know, the entrepreneurs because they're not doing it the way you're supposed to do it according to all the rules. And I think we need to set people free to experiment, to try things, and but clearly focus, you know, clearly holding on to the Wesleyan gospel, Wesleyan approach to the gospel.
Right. Yeah. One last question, if that's okay. I'm curious if you wouldn't mind just sharing some of your own personal practices that you engage in, especially in times of dryness or even despair. What are things that you go to help you through those times?
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that's just helpful to me is just taking a walk and praying. So I, you know, at my best, I take a, you know, 30-minute, 40-minute prayer walk, and I just go out and I walk and I pray and I keep my pocket testament with me. And sometimes I'm walking down the road reading my pocket testament or praying the scriptures. And I find praying the scriptures really helpful. You know, I start every day, and this is just whether it's a good time or a bad time, I just start every morning, you know, on my knees, and I'm just next to my bed. And here I am, God, once more, I'm everything I am and have is yours. Please guide and lead me. Holy Spirit, please fill me and shape me and mold me. And so I find, you know, prayer and scripture reading. After I've done that, my next thing I do every morning is to read the scriptures and to pray. I take time away every summer, and I think a pastor is a fool for not taking all their vacation. That's not wise. It's not, you know, take every minute of it and then work your butt off when you're in the office. You know, when you're there, work hard. But taking vacation, the church gives me a week every year to read and outline and prepare sermons. And so I spend a week just looking at what am I going to preach over the next 2 years? What's God calling me to address in the sermons? What biblical characters, parts of the Bible, questions of theology, Christian ethics do I need to address to help this congregation and for God to speak through me to help them? And so, you know, that kind of thing, the reading, the reflecting, the I try to be engaged in mission activities, although I don't do nearly as much of that as I'd like to do. But, you know, this month I'm going to Honduras, and, you know, I was like, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to go to Honduras. I didn't want to take a mission trip this summer. But I felt like, okay, how can I ask people to do this if I'm not doing it? And what I know is I'm going to go there, and I'm going to come back energized and fired up and ready to, you know, pour into our people about why it's important that we're engaged in ministry with our partners around the world. And so I think trying to live this gospel that I actually, you know, that I preach, I don't really have any other silver bullets. I just think, you know, I will tell you that, you know, I know folks say don't use your sermon prep time as your devotional time, and I don't use it as my sole devotional time, but I love the fact that every week I get paid to read and study and reflect and research and, you know, the scriptures and how they relate to daily life, and that fuels me too, and it keeps me going.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think most people would say they don't necessarily have the magic answer, but just have habits that they've cultivated over the years. And those are the things that in times of joy and in times of despair, those are the things that get you through it no matter what.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Well, Adam Hamilton is the author of many books. His latest book is Moses in the Footsteps of the Reluctant Prophet. He's the senior pastor of Church of the Resurrection. And Adam, I'm so grateful for your taking your time to speak with us today.
Hey, Christian, I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate you and your ministry. I just think it's a great example and model for the rest of us, and God bless you and your listeners.
Great, thanks. That is this week's podcast. Thanks again to Adam Hamilton for speaking with me. You can order any of Adam's books at his website, adamhamilton.org, and he's on Twitter at Rev Adam Hamilton. He has a very active Facebook page, too. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast, as my next conversation is with Alicia Gonzalez, the founder of Chicago Run, an influential nonprofit in Chicago that is having an impact on the lives of thousands of students through exercise and leadership development. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. And the music from this podcast comes from Enoch Kim. You can find out more about Enoch by typing in The Muse Maker on YouTube, Twitter, and SoundCloud. Thanks again for listening. That's this week's episode. Thanks again to Adam Hamilton for speaking with me. You can order any of Adam's books at his website, adamhamilton.com. And I hope you will subscribe. Blah, blah, blah.